This is short. Michael, you said, the demonstrations were unprecedented. What do you think the focus or message should have been or should be in the future?
Well, okay. We have to get down to root causes and conditions. I mean, it was great to see 2 million people in the street in Rome. How many people in the street here? 500,000, 800,000 you had here in San Francisco, 1 million in New York maybe. It was great to see that, but the energy bounced off because it was directed at a part of the government where they knew that they were not vulnerable. They knew the war was going to happen anyway. I see, if we're talking just in terms of demonstrations, if you want to have a demonstration on something, go out and have a demonstration over the fact that $3 trillion of your money has been stolen out of the Pentagon in 2 years. That will scare the devil out. Because I'll tell you this, people in San Francisco having a demonstration is not viewed in the rest of the country like it's viewed by the people in San Francisco. Did you know that? It's those crazy wackos in San Francisco. Okay? Now, but 500,000 people in San Francisco protesting over $3 trillion of taxpayer money and the fact that every American's going to have to spend 3 or 4, 5 working years of their lives to pay their share of money that's been stolen. And yet, guess who lost the money? Not only the Pentagon and HUD, but it was contractors who manage them called Lockheed Martin and DynCorp. Now, you start connecting the dots on money, you start reconnecting the American people instead of separating them along racial, ideological, and political lines. Find out what the American people have in common and protest there, but find out what causes the war. Peter's right. You know, I totally agree with him. Where we allowed a guy who stole the election to occupy the White House. Why should he have any reason to fear us for anything else? Get your priorities straight and address the cause, not the symptom. Kyle.
I just want to take this opportunity, not for a question so much as a thank you. Oh, no, please, please.
Ask a question.
I just want to thank Stephen, who has not spoken, who's up here on the stage. I approached Stephen in August of last year to produce this film, and he's done an extraordinary job, and he and many others that he brought into the project. And I want to thank all the panelists and every one of you who have contributed to what is an important piece. And I also want to thank Carol, who's just a tireless worker and activist who put this together. Thank you very much, Carol, for doing this.
And you should know that this is Kyle Hentz, and we have to thank him, too.
Well, thank you very much. If I just want to say just one last thing, there was a minor miracle that happened in New York City on March 31st. A new watchdog group called 9/11 Citizens Watch was formed, and we managed to get a press conference to be held during the lunch break of the first open hearing of the National Commission. We were 2 floors above with a view of the Statue of Liberty, saying they're not going to get away without answering these questions, okay? And the victim families were there, and Mindy Kleinberg, and you can link to her testimony on our site, Mindy Kleinberg asked more detailed, hard-ass questions than I have seen in print anywhere. And she lost her husband, and they're not going to rest, I'm not going to rest, and we're going to hold them accountable.
Well, every rule was made to be broken, eh?
Okay.
Folks may recall the name Chalabi. Chalabi is the designated, president, let's put it that way, of Iraq, so designated by the War Department. Chalabi, believe it or not, an Arab and an Iraqi is a Zionist. Jay Garner, who will be the American proconsul in Iraq, I'm sure you know that name, is likewise a Zionist. Both of these guys, of course, non-Jewish Zionists. Now, commentary is part of the democratic process. I'm getting to a question. Now, the movie, as good as it was, did not feature any of the neocons, the neoconservatives, except for a very brief glimpse of Crystal, Bill Crystal, who I'm sure 95% of the people in this audience wouldn't recognize. I did notice that Mr. Zwicker and Peter Dale Scott mentioned the neocons. It's very important that people understand who the neoconservatives are, Jewish Zionist Likudniks. 25 of them in the administration, they've taken over the War Department and taken over the White House. Now, I would like some... The question is implicit. Thank you very much.
All right.
What's the question?
I mean...
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the question, if I get it correctly, is what's the significance of this? He has correctly identified a state of affairs which exists. Israeli influence in the current administration is inordinate. It is unjustified. If you look at, and everybody get this straight for anybody out there who wants to come at me with some other accusations. Israel is a country. Judaism is a religion. Israel is a country. Judaism is a religion. Okay? Get that straight. Now, Iraq was in violation of 17 UN resolutions. Israel is in violation of 64. Okay? We could take that discussion a long way. Here's my point. The way I analyze this, and I've had some feedback from David McMichael, who you saw in the video there, and there are some very high-level corporate-level attorneys and other sources who share with me. And the way I view it is this. We have a plan for globalization which would call for the forming of the corporation called Planet Earth. And the CEO of that corporation is to be, and the main stockholder is to be the United States. The main stockholder, the chairman of the board, if you will, with other regions or interests holding separate shares. Let's say Britain holding 12%, China holding 17%, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a particular CEO management firm called the Neocons was selected by the board of directors to implement the plan. And that particular CEO is the United States and Israel advocating Zionists because they have to manipulate public opinion. They also have to deliver the corporate, financial, and economic assets of the world into the portfolio of the global corporation. The Neocon CEO group has failed to deliver Europe into that board of directors. Yes, there's absolute total pro-Zionist elements in that, and Peter and I were talking, of course, Israel was saying, well, now go get rid of Syria next, or go get rid of, you know, Hamas or Hezbollah in Syria next. But the point is this. What I see is that there is a feud breaking now. We've had Eagleburger publicly say in Britain that if Bush invades Syria, he should be impeached immediately. Eagleburger was his father's Secretary of State. We've had Jay Rockefeller calling for an investigation of the Bush administration over the forged Niger documents on uranium. The neocons, neo-libs are feuding in the board of directors about how to implement the plan. But don't get confused about what the plan is. They can fire the CEO and bring in another one, regroup their losses and move ahead. Don't get distracted.
I'd like, can I just add a bit?
Yeah.
This is very important stuff, and it's very important we get it straight. Halabi is the hero of the Pentagon and the hero of the neocons. He is loathed by the CIA, and he is loathed by the State Department. And he's just arrived and has sort of appointed himself the chief spokesperson, and I don't know how long this is going to go on. There is, I think, you can see different constituencies in the Bush administration, and the two biggest are the neocons on the one hand, some of whom actually worked with Netanyahu in Israel, and the oil companies on the other. The two biggest lobbies in Washington historically have been the oil lobby, which works mostly through the government and the CIA, and AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, which works mostly through Congress. Both those lobbies are far larger than they ought to be because historically they've been mostly fighting each other. And that changed in the mid-80s when America's relationship to Saudi Arabia began to change. And the Arabists and the oil people ceased to believe that the Saudi royal family was the best bulwark of America's interest in the region. And they began to cast around for another country where they could have a base, and Iraq presented itself. So what we have seen recently is two very powerful lobbies, Jewish and oil, agreeing for the first time on Iraq and possibly agreeing in the future on Iran. We'll have to wait and see.
Israeli?
I will say Israeli, right? AIPAC is Israel. Well, the point I'm trying to make is
Peter's wife is Jewish.
That we are not dealing with a single homogeneous power here. There is a lot of division in Washington, and we should be working to expose and heighten those divisions.
We should make them fight each other more.
Yes. And just before this question comes on, I just can't resist adding that AIPAC is very seriously led by Christian fundamentalists. And if you read Haaretz, they say that those Christian fundamentalists are even stronger here than the Zionist lobby.
Bush uses the dispensationalists to feed upon and to cement that irrational coalition together.
Yeah.
And Enron finances it.
Yes.
Question. Perfect.
Yeah, this seems very complex. You're talking about a lot of things that I'm not quite aware of. But the question I have for you is the demonstrations, a lot of support worldwide, here in the States, the same thing. But, where are we going to be in essential deep influence on changing this regime at home? Where are we going to get to them to have an effect? That's my question. I think Martin Luther King said it, invade Washington. I think that's where it has to come. And
Texas.
And I don't like being the cannon fodder for our government's foreign policy. I defend the streets of San Francisco here, and I do not like the thought of losing my life because of our foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And what I want to ask the crowd is a question. How many of you are willing to stand up and give your life to change the regime here at home? Because I don't think this government will hesitate to use the weapons of mass destruction they have on its own people.
Thank you.
Can I just say one thing, Mike? Can I say one thing? Can I just answer that quickly? I just want to say, I think that to answer your first question, I think that, if you truly want to defeat this regime, we've moved into information warfare. We've moved beyond, and you can see this happening in Iraq with just the limited number of casualties. We've moved into what some people would term psychological warfare. And I think it's very important for us all, you're seeing everyone in this group, and what we're trying to do at GNN is to craft messages which can compete with the din and the sparkle of the mainstream spectacle, which has been created to distract the people from the main source of information which is available. And also what's happened, so that's the first thing I would say, is that I think you can go and lay down your life if you want, and I think that it may come to that at some point. But before that can even be relevant, we need to focus the mass consciousness on being able to question articulately in their homes, let alone in public places like this, those surgical questions which will enable us to overcome the distraction they're giving us. Secondly, I would just say that it's really important that everyone really push out the messages you're finding in the independent progressive media. Peter has a website. Mike has a website. Reva has an organization. We have a website. They're all out there fighting, but we have to not let ourselves become marginalized or stay marginalized by the Fox networks of the world. And that's going to become, that starts here in this meeting, and it expands geometrically if we want it to.
We also have to get very creative.
I just want to add a little too, because I had a reaction when Mike seemed to undervalue the need. It's hard to say all of the above, but in terms of demonstrations, because we were demonstrating against the Vietnam War, I think it ended sooner. Because we were demonstrating about the Iraq War, I think it started later. We really gummed up the works.
True.
We really, really did. And short of putting our lives on the line, which frankly these days in Oakland we are when they're shooting wooden bullets at us, they call them non-lethal, but it's just a question of degree. We have to stop business as usual. I think that's the term that really resonates. And so we talk about global capital. I'll talk about capitalism. I'll talk about imperialism. Maybe we should talk about global warming. But we need to tie in the issues. And then finally, also mentioning Martin Luther King, the reason that he became anti-Vietnam War and he struggled with his people about it is he saw the impact on the domestic economy of imperialist foreign policy. And we have to link the domestic issues with the foreign policy. But I think we have to be out in the streets and we have to tie it together. And I don't want to undervalue the strength and the courage of people who are out there protesting.
In one sentence, it is, I think, at this stage,
less important than to stop business than usual in San Francisco, which I don't think worries Bush very much, right, than it is to bring this kind of message and this kind of meeting to Wichita and to Topeka and to...
And first of all, I'd like to apologize if I made it sound like I didn't value it. I am a tactician. I'm a guy, I'm a former street cop. At the end of the day, it matters whether you get shot or don't, you go home or you don't, whether the good people get out alive and the bad guys stop hurting people. That's what matters to me. Nothing else matters. And what I see is, what I want to see is more return on investment for the energy and the risk. Now, let me ask this, because what I hear is, it drives me crazy. People think, okay, well, we can go to the streets or we can have a revolution and go die. Wait a minute. How many people, by show of hands, now you be honest and you tell me the truth, use AOL or MSN for your email? How many? Or for your server? Why are you paying money to people who lie to you? That's CNN, that's Time Warner, that's MSNBC. You don't think a thing about writing a check every month to give power to people who bring you bad news and lie to you. What's wrong with you? Get creative. Vote with your money. Find other ways to fight. Civil disobedience will work in very creative ways. There's a whole ton of other options.
Yes. Since 9/11/01, the U.S. left media has failed miserably in covering 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I have been following your critique of the mainstream media. My question to you is, Mr. Swigger, what can you do to criticize the U.S. left media for censoring the 9/11 cover-up? And please, to the audience, please check out leftgatekeepers.com and questionquestions.com.
Well, I'll try to practice what I preach and be really brief. My self-appointed job is as a media critic, and I'm very grateful that I have a platform in Canada into 8 million households. And it's not an accident that that platform is not-for-profit and it's non-corporate. So there needs to be a change in as much as possible. It has to be a transformation. It can't be a revolution in the ownership and control of the media. And Stephen might as well have used weapons of mass distraction as his phrase. And I couldn't agree more with Mike that we should think carefully as consumers. We have tremendous consumer power, and there's something called Boycott Brand America. It's worth looking at.
Cesar Chavez did a pretty good job. You know what I'm telling you?
Yes, sir.
My question is, why the deafening silence regarding the demolition of the Twin Towers in Building 7? To me, that's the core of the whole 9/11 scam, because all these other things, even the NORAD stand-down could be, maybe thought of as some kind of monumental screw-up, but those buildings were either demolished or, there's no other way to explain it.
Does anyone want to address that?
I'll just speak for the film for a sec. It's a good question. We dealt with a whole spectrum of issues. And though that wasn't one, we just found that was one issue at the time we were making the film, that we didn't have a spokesperson who could really articulately decimate that argument. But I think it's worth checking out. And again, there were so many questions we had to deal with, and really we wanted to deal with a spectrum of speakers. And you can see them here, just even reflected here, who could speak to things they were experts in. And at that time, I think it was still a developing story.
Very quickly, too. That's a no-win argument with the American people. The evidence has been destroyed. And let me finish. For how many years since 1963? For 38 years or however many years, we've had a film showing John Kennedy shot from the front. 40 years, okay?
40, thank you.
Jesus. 40 years, okay? Nothing changed in this government, okay? Whether or not the Twin Towers were blown up by destruction from demolition or inside is a debate you can engage in for the same 40 years. At the end of that 40 years, you're going to be at the exact same place we are with the Kennedy assassination. That's another reason why I didn't touch Thierry Meyssan in France. I have a large following in France, wrote a great book, sold a million copies, showed no plane hit the Pentagon. But I haven't touched that debate. You know why? Because you can't penetrate the American consciousness here. What has succeeded in penetrating, and this is, and I will take credit for one thing with From the Wilderness. I made the government do something with regard to 9/11. And what I made them do in the Joint House-Senate hearings on 9/11 was I made them admit to having received foreknowledge and some warnings, and I also made them admit that the Bush administration knew that aircraft could be used as weapons. So, because the evidence still exists, the documentary record of the government statements and the news stories still exists, and without that weapon, you don't achieve the victory on the battlefield.
Well, I respect that question. That there are many, many, many issues within the events of 9/11, and we can't get to them all tonight. So we'll just have to cut that one off, unfortunately.
We need
but it's
an
great
aftermath too, and maybe you can make it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. You know, a lot of times people. Sorry, but just quickly, a lot of we all do our own little bit, and a lot of times people like we got a lot of. For putting George Soros on our thing, you know, there's a million things you can complain about. I hear that. People don't need to make your own media. I mean, please, like, we do our stuff at home on a laptop computer. I mean, you can do it, really. And people have to be encouraged to, yeah, stop being spectators and critics, stop being passive voyeurs, become proactive creators, all right?
Question is for Michael Rupert. To what extent do you see the looming crises, engineered, etc., as a race against the clock with environmental collapse? To what extent do you believe those string pullers are viewing their time to implement these kinds of age of wars, gross changes in the way civilizations work to give them to be in the driver's seat for the end game?
Well, I think that regardless of what the other factors are, the main priority of the people who are in power is to stay in power, even if they have to kill 4 billion people to do it. And I'm sure that as we pass peak oil, which is becoming very well documented now, as we go down what's called the Hubbert curve, we are not going to be able to sustain a population which has long overshot now. We're on the downside of production. The population is still increasing. I don't think ecological issues will drive. I think energy issues will drive and are driving first. Mother Earth has the ability to shrug her shoulders and throw us off like a bad cold or a bad virus, and she probably will at some point, because we don't deserve, we haven't treated it right. But I think energy issues are dominant in terms of what's driving ultimately the decision. So some people have categorized this as a war between the euro and the dollar. What I say that it is that it's a war using the euro and the dollar, the ultimate end game of which is the control of energy, because if there is no energy, euros and dollars have no value. Yes, sir.
I was just going to mention a couple of things, and if people could put out some information regarding these. One is North American Military Command, or NORTHCOM, merger of Canadian, Mexican, U.S. military.
NORAD.
NORTHCOM. And the other is the Operation Urban Warrior that took place in 1999. There were many other things that took place like this throughout the late 90s, and these sort of war games for rounding up U.S. citizens that involved not just Delta Force and National Guard, but involved Dutch troops and Norwegian troops and German troops and so on and so forth.
Does someone want to respond to that, or would we accept that as valid information? I happen to think he's on spot on.
I very briefly, it's moderately something to be concerned about, but the concern about rounding up mass citizens and putting them immediately in concentration camps is, I think, overblown. This is a stratagem that likes to decapitate. They take the leaders out. What they have in place, thanks to Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, and Model Emergency Health Powers Act, which is being passed in some states, is the ability to impose complete control on us through biological means and a stated biological emergency. I think that will happen before that. What he's talking about.
But I will just say that FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Administration, at the time of Oliver North was tasking them for rounding up people who were sympathetic to the Contras and the El Salvadorinos in America. And after North went, I wrote an article called Northwards Without North, pointing out that FEMA did not cancel the plans, and they've always maintained those concentration camps. I don't think it's on their front burner, but they don't want to let go of it either. And so the plans have been there. The plans have been, I'm sure, dusted off in the present.
And I agree with Mike that it's not their top priority right now, but I still think it's worth publicizing that they exist.
What to you is the most damning or the most smoking gun or the most convincing, compelling piece of evidence in that particular piece of the puzzle?
Clearly the fighters. In my book, using this tremendous research that made this possible, particularly from Nafis Ahmed, who I want to give due credit to, and also to Paul Thompson of the Center for Cooperative Research with the most incredible timeline. I built a little timeline called Old Lucy, and then, well, he built it on mine, but his is amazing. So I took that and what I found out, and then Mary Schiavo also added some pieces, but I think the number may be wrong. But for the sake of discussion, 94 times, I mean somewhere between 80 and 100 cases in the year prior to 9/11, U.S. Air National Guard fighters were automatically scrambled in cases of commercial aircraft going off course. Okay? That's a tremendous, okay? And it's automatic. Now, you compare that with the NORAD FAA regulations, which state specifically that when one or two of these conditions exist, i.e., doesn't respond to a radio request from control, from the air traffic control, loses radio contact, the instruction says, you shall assume a hijack has occurred, and you shall scramble, you shall notify FAA and NORAD immediately to scramble fighters. With that being that clear, in 94 cases, or 90-some cases in the year prior, I have a flow chart. It's going to be, in my book, a pullout, like 8-page, 7-foot-long timeline that shows the 26-minute delay, 36-minute delays, where those procedures, which had never been followed, or which had been followed 90 times in the year before, were broken systematically. So that could only have happened, I will say this very clearly, as a result of direct intervention by the National Command Authority, the President, Vice President, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, period.
I mean, will somebody come forward, do you think, at some point and say, look, this is the order we received, you were told not to do this?
Well, what I document in my book is that several whistleblowers have come forward, and they've paid some serious prices for it, on a small level. What we don't know, and what has been probably one of the most closely guarded state secrets, is the name of the person who was sitting in the role of the National Hijack Coordinator on the day of 9/11. Nobody has even discussed the name or discussed the position, yet I've tracked everything into that one console.
I think it's
worth... We don't know.
And let's just add here that either one day before or 2 days before the complete war plan for fighting in Afghanistan arrived in the White House, either on September 9th or, on, according to Woodward's book, September 10th.
Sir.
To all panelists, I'm a proud American. I would gladly go to the streets to fight for freedom. Do you think it would come to that? And why shouldn't all Americans march on Washington today and just demand the recognition of the Bush regime?
Reba?
Why should we not demand the stepping down of the Bush regime? Is that your question? I think that's good. In fact, one of the things, vote2impeach.org, everybody should vote to impeach. The National Lawyers Guild has already taken a position nationally that... that this administration has committed crimes that are worthy of impeachment, and we should make them step down. It was specific both to post 9/11 repressive legislation, which is unconstitutional, and at the time we were just looking about going into Afghanistan, so it was a violation of international law as well. NLG.org, NationalLawyersGuild.org.
I'm just, because I see a lot of interest in the faces, I'm going to stretch this clock a little bit, another 5 minutes. I hope we'll be all right. Yes.
Are we destined to have a confrontation with China? And Dr. Scott, in reference to former Chancellor Dr. Kerr, how he was treated by the FBI, did you yourself suffer anything like that? And with Ms. Reva, I am in such awe and gratitude to you. I have no questions.
Very quickly, in terms of energy, there is no question that China is the end game for oil. China's demand, Chinese auto purchases went up 50% in 1 year, last year. Okay, and Western economy, capitalist economy, depends upon selling consumer goods, which run on electricity, which run on oil, which run on energy. Chinese energy demand is skyrocketing. China's the endgame competitor for oil. Are they on the board of directors? Sure, but the board of directors is different from ownership. Board of directors run the company. Ownership is the apportionment of shares. So we see separate battles going on here for who controls and who will wind up in the endgame. But, I've even seen it being acknowledged in the Council on Foreign Relations, and I hate to agree with them, but that seems that we're reading the same map. China is the end game for the global energy struggle.
I just add to that before getting into myself that America putting a forward base 200 miles from the West Chinese border is a pretty clear indication that at a minimum, America wants to control the terms under which Central Asian oil and gas, particularly gas, I think, reach China. And they might prefer that it go all the way out to the Indian Ocean and be shipped in Western tankers up to Chinese ports in the east to assure control. Now, as for myself, Seth Rosenfield, who did that research for the, eventually, I guess it was the Chronicle, he did it initially for the Examiner, he asked to get my FBI file. I tried to get it, well, I did get it in 1978. I just asked for the headquarters file FBI, which was a mistake, because most of it would have been here in San Francisco. Headquarters file was 985 pages. But I don't feel that was particularly oppressive. A more oppressive thing was the things they were doing with my telephone, making it very difficult to hear certain people and controlling the volume up and down. So every now and then it was like this. But, you know, believe me, having lived in Poland and some other places, if that's all they're going to do, it shouldn't be a deterrent to anybody to go out and protest. Don't worry about it.
Because of the dependency on oil involved in all this discussion, I was wondering, do you think that publicity and promotion of the many new free energy machines, such as Tom Bearden's machine or Dr. Stephen Greer's machine of the Disclosure Project, do you think that would help stop our government's push to control the oil in the Middle East?
There was an incredible quote I saw recently in a Wall Street Journal story, and it was quoting Sheikh Zaki Yamani, who was one of the founders of OPEC, or the founder of OPEC, and there was another sheikh who was talking. And the journal talked about the sheikh saying, yeah, I was sitting in this bar in Vienna, and these guys came up and talked to me about this car engine that ran on oil, on water. And he said, if I had believed it was true, I would have bought it and killed it. Now, what we're dealing with is, see, you talk about Bearden's, which is Scalar, and Greer's, I don't know. You know, there may be this free energy thing. It may be a myth, it may be real, but the point is this. We will never know if it's real until we remove the people who are oppressing the truth from coming to the surface anyway. There are enormously huge problems with changing of infrastructure. Okay, you cannot retool Detroit overnight and throw all the auto workers, all the downstream people who sell the cars out of work, take their money out of the economy. We have monstrous infrastructure problems to be solved. But I don't know scientifically, so I'll shut up and say we will never know the truth until we change a top-down, hierarchical, oppressive, lying, dishonest, corrupt, criminal system. Period.
You shouldn't hold back like that, Mike.
My question is for Ms. Enting. What truth do you think, what information will come out in the trillion-dollar lawsuit by the survivors of September 11th against the Saudi government and other defendants?
I couldn't even speculate. I'm sorry. Is anybody else want to
say that? I don't think any of the suits are going anywhere. First of all, the anti-Saudi suits, I think, were our political dynamite, but in one case, there was a suit filed by an attorney here, Stanley Hilton, in San Francisco. And I finally got to talk to him or communicate with him, which really comes to the heart of the truth. But as soon as the suit was filed, the government stepped in and said, we're controlling all documents. We're invoking the Classified Information Procedures Act. We'll control everything in discovery. We get to see it all before the judge sees it. So those suits are going nowhere. Sorry.
Two questions. One would be, due to the voracious greed and lust for power,
how do we stop the militarization of space? Because I fear that, they're going to decide what natural resources they want from where, and they want labor on its knees worldwide, including us, so that we're begging for any kind of work. That's one. Number two is I've always been suspicious of elections since I was 14 years old. And I'm thinking ahead, and I'm thinking under what circumstances could they suspend elections? Is it possible they could suspend this coming election in 2004, a year and a half from now, because we're at war?
They don't have to. All the voting machines are now electronic, and there have been two court rulings saying that the software was proprietary information, didn't have to be shown to the public, so all the elections can be controlled, and there are direct ownership links with major Republican donors and major corporate donors between the owners of the voting software. Chuck Hagel of Nebraska is one. They don't have to suspend the elections. What they have to do, what is hardest for them to do, and what is increasingly harder for them to do, is to maintain the illusion that we're living in a democracy.
Right.
See, we have to push them out of their envelope to wake people up. Don't pay any attention to that man behind the curtain.
Got any ideas?
Yeah, we keep stirring the pot, I almost said a bad word, as hard as we possibly can, but we get very creative. We don't give up when we say protest didn't fail. That's what everybody did in the 60s. Okay, now let's go have a revolution and pick up guns and I'll go get massacred. There's a whole spectrum of ideas and options in between there. There's a whole lot of other things we can do, and I talk about many in my book, and it's not fair of me to give you the whole lot of answers right now. But they also interact. They support each other. 2 million people in the street might cause somebody else to do something else. That's the collective consciousness of Carl Jung, which makes ultimately my opinion, what the human race is facing right now is a spiritual choice to either evolve or perish, grow up or die.
Military control of space. Military control of space. What do we do about
that? Very quickly, it's very easy in America, living in the belly of the beast, to feel defeated at times, especially after you protest the war and the war happens. We have two very strong allies. The first ally is the truth, and we have to go after the truth and get it for ourselves and get it for others. And the second ally, don't forget, is the world opinion of the rest of the world, where the media is not controlled to the same extent that it is here. Don't limit yourself to news access from American sources. Make sure you're reading the British press, the Australian press, because it's much more heartening to get the news from outside. And what you're slowly seeing as a result, Bush said, "I want to unite people." Well, he is uniting people. He's uniting the whole world against him. And we have to be part of that alliance. We have to reach out to other people in America and other people in the rest of the world and draw our strength from that.
Quickly, and then I want to address the military thing. The term I use is the emperor has no clothes, and more people get it. And you talk about impeachment, and you talk about the stolen election, any crowd, people will like it. So talk about it. People really get it. And in terms of being part of the world community, it was the first time that it felt that way. I think the internet is part of it, but we knew that we were part of a world community protesting this war. In terms of militarization, real quick, a couple of months ago, the students at City College campus on Ocean Avenue harassed the Army recruiters so much that they stopped coming to City College campus. We have to resist military recruitment. And there should be draft counseling in the schools. There should be conscientious objection counseling in the schools. If there's ROTC in the schools, they're teaching war. They should teach peace, too. Demands it of your school districts.
I think one thing. Also, just important to include children in this discussion. I think so often this thing becomes so technical, becomes conspiratorial, and it's difficult to understand how to communicate to young people. And I really just encourage everyone here not to, propagandize to your children, but definitely to include them in a way that allows them to ask questions, to create a safe place for them to ask questions.
I'm reminded of Robert J. Lipton's book, Indefensible Weapons, which I read 20 years ago, about nuclear weapons. And one of the things he says is that something soft like democracy can't coexist with plutonium, because the fear of the use of such weapons will make people run to a system of governance where they just want to be protected against such terrible weapons.
And that's a comment that I throw out to everybody. I want to ask a question of Mike. Recently on your website, you had a piece about SARS, the severe acute respiratory syndrome, which is coming through Asia. And it was, I thought, a little paranoid, perhaps, that this thing was about population control and an experiment in some of the things you've been talking about, martial law and whatnot. And as a physician, we're pretty concerned about this disease, which seems quite contagious and lethal. So I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more about that case, please. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that we're seeing, when that story was written, it was written by, I didn't write it, Len Horowitz wrote it, who is a doctor of dentistry, is a master in public health from Harvard and a couple of other degrees. And Len Horowitz is the guy who firmly backed the CIA, backed the government into a corner over anthrax, proving that it was the AIM strain coming from the CIA on 9/11. Len Horowitz did that. Len made the point that at the time that he wrote the piece, that the death rate at the time was 4%. Now, I understand the death rate is increasing, apparently as a result of some kind of mutation or interaction in the environment, which is now raising a whole different specter. But, I mean, look, I was a policeman, I was a detective, and I try to start with the obvious things. I don't jump to conclusions, but we deal with things called clues. And the fact that SARS appeared exactly when the invasion of Iraq started was highly suspicious to me. The fact that it appeared only in the Far East at first as a point of origin, which China had more than anybody else, aside from France, Russia, and Germany, tactically the economic ability to pull the plug on the American war effort through the trade deficit and other economic means. I became suspicious. That doesn't mean I jumped to a conclusion, but I said, there's a clue of something, and let's go look at it. Horowitz's piece was a real eye-opener in terms of the math that he did just initially on what SARS was. Now, it may be serious, but are there not much more deadly diseases out there that if we saw the outbreaks of which, I mean, is it correct to say, if you're a physician, let me ask you, because I don't know, is SARS as dangerous as we are being led to think, or are there more dangerous diseases out there to which we're not reacting as stringently?
I think the fact that it has spread to healthcare workers at the rate that it has and the lethality that it has, and now we're told that it's transmitted through sewer systems, water, plumbing, not just person-to-person contact. It's in something I got today, and that makes it a pretty scary disease.
Okay.
So I want you to be successful in your efforts in From the Wilderness, and I think you have to be very careful in how you put together the tea leaves and coming to conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I think your credibility is at risk.
Okay. So what you're saying is I should look more deeply into what we published
and
about
thanks
SARS.
For the fantastic job you're doing.
Okay. No, I will. I will.
If I could, before we might just zip through the last questions, and there's still interest here. Before we take the next question, I come from the SARS capital of the world, Toronto. A researcher in Toronto reported that on March 11th, an FBI agent was arrested in Guangdong province. The agent's name is given. I don't have the URL and the website and so on, but there is some evidence that something fishy was going on in the country of China. The United States has engaged in germ warfare for a long time, and actually the Chinese are familiar with it because germs were dropped on China at the time of the Korean War. Bats were infected with plague, and they were dropped from planes and fluttered down all over the place. So the Chinese have had some experience with this. So have the Cubans, of course. So you can't rule it out. I think the key thing is to look into it a lot more and to be very careful about sourcing everything six ways from Sunday. I forget which mic it is. Thank you.
I just wanted to point out that if you have a computer and an email account for free, there's software that you can send email to thousands of people at once for a couple $100s. You can have a reach of millions easily. On that, I wanted to ask, what facts would you present in an email campaign that are the best sourced, other than obviously the air defense failure and and prior knowledge.
Insider trading, no question about it.
The cover-up, you know, it emerged quite early. They were looking for the smoking gun to link this bombing to Al-Qaeda and to bin Laden. And they actually announced they had found the smoking gun because they had found that this money was being wired from the United Arab Emirates to some of the, to Atta and some of the other hijackers, and that just before 9/11, some of the money was wired back. And the FBI revealed the name at the time of the man who was at the other end, the UAE name. His name was Saeed Sheikh. He's become very famous since because Umar Mohammed Saeed Sheikh has since been convicted for the murder of Daniel Pearl in Pakistan, a murder which he probably did not commit. But without ever denying what they had said, the American press has just forgotten that they had identified, the FBI is identifying him as the man who had passed the money to the bombers. Now, he's not just, it's not just that we know who he was, but he's very clearly an agent of ISI, the Pakistani intelligence organization. Now, you might say, well, the Americans just covered up and chose to forget about his role in it because they persuaded Musharraf to bring Pakistan in on the side of America. And there's no doubt about it when he said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. That was a message to Musharraf and to Pakistan. But the fact is they're covering it up. And then there's the added thing, which is mentioned in the movie, but I'm not certain is fact, that the head of ISI, General Mahmoud Ahmad, is said by Indian intelligence, and the Indians are not the most objective source here, but they're a very good source. They have very good intelligence. They said that Saeed wired that money on the authority of General Mahmoud Ahmad. Now, it is undeniable that he was in Washington at the time talking to top people in the government, and the government even tried to cover that up. There's the business about Condé Rice's press conference being edited, so they take out ISI chief out of the transcript of the conference, even though you can hear it being said on the tape. So in a hundred ways, the government has been covering up. And it has been refusing, it has resisted as hard as it can to let anybody else look into it. One of the reasons we're getting so much control here, it's not, I mean, there's the positive reason, they want to get us ready for more invasions and so on, but there's also the self-protection reason that they don't want us to know what their role was. And I think that that is something that we should make very clear to people.
Yeah.
Several panelists have touched upon possible positive developments for humanity coming out of 9/11, but let me just ask specifically straight, what potential for good do you see as coming out of 9/11?
Good question.
Well, sorry. Morton Sobel says the greater the more effective we are, the more repression we're going to have to face. But we have no choice but to do it. I actually think a pinnacle of our resistance was Seattle, and I actually think a lot of this was in the Pikes in Seattle because we really did shut them down. I think we need to take our work seriously, and as Peter said, you know, them listening in on our phones should not stop our work. We have to keep doing the work. We know they're going to be watching us. We need to try to have them follow the law as we try to gum up the works. We have no choice, but we need to take repression seriously because that's what we're looking at.
Two different levels I live on. One is a spiritual level in which I truly believe that nothing real can be harmed and there is no power other than the Tao that I believe in, which encompasses all religions, which is the nice Zen opinion, but however, I have been shot before and I have had some painful experiences, and there's a part of me that on the level, if you're asking on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it that the good guys are going to win in the near future, the answer is about 2. And things are going to have to get much worse before they get better. That seems to be the way of life, to quote Khalil Gibran from the Prophet, your pain is the breaking of a shell which encloses your understanding. We need a little more shell breaking first. And I think that will come painfully.
but I think we're getting a better anti-war movement than we did in the 60s. I think we should, as somebody who was there in the 60s, I think we should admit, frankly, that mistakes that were made by the anti-war movement in the 60s are part of the problem that we face now, because a great many people in that anti-war movement declared war on America. That was their rhetoric. And America heard them and organized right back and produced the radical right and all kinds of things that are plaguing us now. And today's movement is much more mature, and I think that there's a big way ahead, which involves hopefully doing something to heal the very profound divisions in this country. People, a Bush minority government can rule as long as this country is deeply divided. It's our responsibility to try and reach the red states, the heartland, and persuade them that we are the true Americans just as they are the true Americans. And what's going on in Washington has very little to do with America. It's a minoritarian program being imposed from above that should be rejected by everybody who cares deeply about this country.
I just have one. I'll say that as for 9/11, it's, you know, really what's happened is people are seeing the mainstream media. The mainstream has become a monolithic entity. It's become an organ of the government. And in that way, it's almost worked to the favor of the independent progressive media that people, I think, increasingly are going to look for alternative sources of information. And that is one of the small benefits.
You've been listening to a panel discussion that took place in San Francisco in April on the government cover-up of the facts surrounding the attacks of September 11, 2001. Thanks to Sue Supriano for providing that material to us. Sue also spoke with a Canadian graphic artist who has designed a deception dollar to raise awareness of the 9/11 cover-up.
My guest today is Blaine Mahan, the artist who did the deception dollar. The deception dollar looks very much like real money, but it's not real money at all. It says 9/11 very clearly on one side, and on the other side it says fraudulent event note, the United States of Aggression. Then, as I say, it's covered by many different websites, but the art is incredible. So what brought you to create this deception dollar?
I am an artist from Calgary, Canada, and have been involved in the truth movement for September 11th, basically, since it started. And I would consider myself a September 11th skeptic, which is to say that I don't particularly agree with the official version of the official explanation of events that that has come from the Bush administration and from the intelligence community and from the essentially from the American media and the global media, mass media. So right away I was interested in trying to find ways to make people aware of the fact that there was a growing community of people that are asking questions about the event and trying to bring awareness to a larger audience of that fact, the fact that there are skeptics. Last year we had brought in an exceptional speaker in June, a gentleman by the name of Mike Rupert, and Mike Rupert came to speak on the truth and lies of 9/11. As a graphic designer, I was working on posters and flyers and advertisements for the event so that we could get the word out that Mike was in town. And as I was developing my posters for that event, a friend in Los Angeles had sent me some images of American currency. And so began to play with the image digitally with the hopes that I was going to be able to use it for the posters for Mike Rupert's event. And so the numbers on the $1 bill were changed. It became the 9/11 bill. In the end, the artwork for the deception dollar wasn't actually used on the posters, and it was put aside. But it was a project that sort of kept coming up. Every time I sat down to work on the bill, there was some new change to make. The fraudulent event note, which replaced Federal Reserve notes on the top of the front of the bill, and then just a bunch of different detail. In the end, what happened was to make people aware of the many exceptional websites that are currently online in relation to the 9/11 sort of skeptic movement. We added the first printing of bills. We've done 5 issues of the bills. The first printing of the bills, there was only 7 websites. I think the most recent issue has 20 different websites on it. So just some exceptional websites that people who have the bills are then able to access.
It's very, very beautifully done, taking off on the symbols of today in some ways. You want to talk a little bit about these symbols and about these websites on the dollar here? Because people are really very attracted to them, and I've given out thousands, but it strikes them right away. I mean, the people really like the picture of Bush, which indeed looks like Bush.
I'd originally planned to have John D. Rockefeller as the face on the deception dollar, and a lot of people thought that was going to be way too obscure, and that nobody would really recognize who that was, or you know why he was on the bills. And so, as I was working on the bills, and it just logically it had to be W on the bills, and so the portrait was done of George Bush. I mean, it started off as a $1 bill. The one over top of the seal on the front of the bills became lie. All of the serial numbers have been changed to represent numbers from September 11th or from something that is connected with the events of September 11th and the skeptics movement. The other seal on the front of the bill has BS on it, in replacement for some of the other letters, and I'm sure that your listeners will know what that suggests.
Do you have any sense of how much around the world the deception dollars are going these days?
We know that they are spreading far and wide. I mean, we've been in contact with some people that have been distributing them in, all over Europe. I mean, there's been a real interest in London, from what I understand, some areas in Germany. We've just spotted them all over the place, and we know there's been a real interest overseas. I mean, the main craving for them has definitely been here in the United States, and then in Canada. I was recently in a print shop in Calgary. I was printing up some deception dollar posters, and I had the proof out on the table, and this gentleman beside me, and this is somebody that I didn't know, didn't recognize and hadn't met before. He spotted the posters and said, "Well," he said, did you design those? You didn't design those, did you?" And I said, "Yeah, it so happens that I did." And he got all excited, and he'd had a friend that had just come up from California and had brought some of the bills up. So it's been amazing to see how they have spread and the interest that has come from the deception dollars.
Do you want to talk about the websites? About the issue of September 11th?
We tried to focus on specifically September 11th related websites. As far as the sites that were originally put on there, GNN.TV, which is the Guerrilla News Network, which is an exceptional site, and the gentlemen at Guerrilla News Network have put out a really good documentary called Aftermath, The Unanswered Questions of 9/11, which is one of the reasons that I'm here in San Francisco for the showing of that documentary.
You should tell people, get out your pencils and paper if you don't know this stuff, these websites, because they will be very interesting for you to go to.
Definitely. Some of the other excellent sites. I mean, Mike Rupert's site, which is and their publishing company, which is From the Wilderness, and the site that we have on the bill for Mike Rupert's site, and you can find out about Mike's video, The Truth and Lies of 9/11, which is copvcia.com. So that's copvcia.com. As far as Canadian information, some excellent work being done by Michelle Chuzadovsky in Ottawa, and their website is globalresearch.ca, which is again one of the sites that was included on the original bills. Yeah, 911pi.com is an excellent site, sort of for an overview of the questions on September 11th. Onlinejournal.com, which is one of the sites that's got sort of a wider range of topics and some exceptional articles and research that's being done there. Questionsquestions.net, 911strike.com. I think like one of the best sites, I mean, sort of central for the September 11th issue is 911pi.com, or at least that's the one that I kind of point people to, because it has all of the links, the URLs that we have on the bill is generally included on that site.
And that was Blaine Mann, designer of the Deception Dollar, speaking with Sue Cipriano. For more information on this program or to contact us, visit us on the web at www.unwelcomeguests.org. And if you appreciate hearing this broadcast in the Ithaca area, please help support Ithaca Community Radio at www.ithacaradio.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.